Today on the 21st Show, among the many areas in which the Trump administration is looking to make generational changes in American policy has to do with food safety and health. We'll talk with two former FDA officials and an Illinois-based researcher about what's happening in Washington and what that could mean for us. We also want to hear from you at 800-222-9455. What do you make of President Trump's actions on this? How are you thinking about what some have warned is the possibility of an increase in foodborne illness? And how have you seen the effects of changing federal food policy in your life? 800-222-9455 is the number throughout the hour. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Like many federal agencies, the Food and Drug Administration has gone through a lot of changes in recent months. FDA Commissioner Marty McCarry outlined some of them yesterday on CBS.
As you know, the FDA has not had a perfect record. Just look at Vioxx or OxyContin. There have been moments when it's been captured by the industry. It is supposed to regulate. That will not happen to the best of my abilities on my watch. And there's a new FDA. There's a new culture. There were redundant services. There were fiefdoms that were fighting and tribal. There was territorialism, duplicate services, multiple redundant adverse event reporting databases. So this is an exciting time where we're streamlining and consolidating a lot of that. And we're also creating a great culture and a great workplace environment for our scientists and reviewers.
So that is the Trump administration perspective. About 20% of the FDA's workers were fired, though some have been brought back. Funding was cut from the agency's budget, and some long-gestating policies were put off, including one aimed at preventing foodborne illness, for example. It would have made it easier to track risky foods, such as eggs and spinach, from the farm to your fridge. So what does all this mean for the safety of our food and drugs? What's the motivation for these changes? And how will this affect us in our day-to-day lives? For more on this, we're joined today by Dr. Susan Main, former director at the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition at the FDA. She's got a PhD in nutritional sciences and is currently professor and department chair of chronic disease epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. Susan Main, welcome to the 21st Show.
My pleasure to be here with you today.
Mitch Zeller is former director at the Center for Tobacco Products at the FDA. An attorney, he has been long involved with health issues related to tobacco, both in and around government. Mitch Zeller, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And finally, Dr. Joseph Feinglass is a research professor of medicine at Northwestern University in Illinois. His work has touched on health policy and disparities, patient safety, social epidemiology, among many other areas. His PhD is in public policy analysis. Joe Feinglass, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
As ever, we want to hear from you at 800-222-9455. If you have questions or you want to talk about how you think these changes might affect you and your family, you can join us today. 800-222-9455 is the number. All right, Susan Main, I'm going to start with you. Tell us about the history of the FDA for people who are not steeped in this stuff. Why does it exist?
Well, the reason the FDA exists is really to protect consumers. And we saw around the turn of the century some really horrendous things happening where we had products that everyone relies on a daily basis, things like milk, that were being contaminated with chemicals like formaldehyde, leading to sicknesses and deaths. And this kept happening, and there really was no federal approach to assure the safety of the food supply for consumers. And so that really led to the creation of the FDA. And you may be familiar with Harvey Wiley, who was really one of the fathers of this work, who really put together a group of individuals who subjected themselves to testing for some of the poisons in foods. And that's really where the FDA got started, is with the establishment of the Pure Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. So its origins are consumer protection from things that we may be consuming or be exposed to on a daily basis.
You say the turn of the century, you're talking about the turn of the 1800s into the 1900s, the sort of Upton
Yeah,
Sinclair
like
stuff.
1906. We're talking about a long time ago. There was a great need to protect consumers.
So your job was the sort of, if you will, the F in FDA. What exactly did that mean?
That meant that I led a center of about 1,100 people that was responsible for the safety and the labeling of about 80% of the US food supply. Primarily, that's all your packaged goods, that's all your produce, that's those types of things. What I did not cover was meat and poultry products, which are largely overseen by the US Department of Agriculture. But for most other things, the safety of that food supply, and that includes outbreak response when we have contaminated food that has made individuals sick. The team of folks that worked in my center was responsible for identifying what foods may be making people sick and then working as quickly as possible to remove those foods from the market.
How would you describe your, what's the term, core values, I guess, when you were doing this work, when you and your team were doing this work?
So it's interesting you asked me that because on day two, when I arrived at FDA, I was asked, how do you intend to lead the FDA? And I said, well, I need to learn more about the work of the center, but my core values are number one, first, do good science. Second, be as transparent as we can with everyone. And third, treat everybody with respect. And that's really important as a regulator because we work with very, very diverse perspectives from industry, from consumer groups, all across the board. And so having respectful engagement with a number of different stakeholders is really important to get regulatory policy correct so you can understand what the challenges may be and avoid unintended consequences.
Joseph Fineglass, I want to bring you into the conversation now of Northwestern University. So, talk about how the FDA sort of fits in the broader federal picture of some of these areas, maybe how it works with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, for example, or the National Institutes of Health.
Sure. Well, of course, nutrition is a huge part of health. And so the FDA regulation of the food supply is crucial to health in the United States. But this is all part of a larger regulatory structure that is now under severe attack by the Trump administration with regard to regulation of corporate interests. And so I'd be happy to talk more about this, but this is also part of what's going on with the destruction of many of the departments in CDC and the huge budget cuts now that are being contemplated for the NIH and firings, mass firings of people. So yes, I mean we're the United States. We have to understand is part of the FDA is part of a bigger picture of a declining health status of the U.S. population. And so, as a health services researcher and a public health professor, we are just shocked that even before the COVID epidemic, the U.S. ranked 40th internationally in life expectancy behind Albania and Lebanon. We're greater than 6 years from the top life expectancy difference from the top countries. And we are plagued with avoidable and premature deaths that are increasing. Some of that has to do with the obesity epidemic, and the whole corporate food industry's role in that is something that I think we're beginning to understand more and more. We have now 40% of American adults who are at that threshold of obesity or above. And we have deaths related to cardiovascular disease and these diseases of despair like alcoholic cirrhosis and suicide and opioids, although they're only a part of the deterioration of American life expectancy. So that's my perspective on it, and I'm glad to talk further.
Yeah, no, we're definitely going to get into some of the changes that the administration is trying to push through. Mitch Zeller, let me bring you into the conversation now. Can you talk about how the FDA goes about ensuring food and drug safety, at least as it has until this point in history?
It does it by following the science and following the law. As Susan said, it's an agency that's been around for well over 100 years, and the vital consumer protection role it plays, regardless of what category of products that we're talking about, is gatekeeper. A science-based regulatory agency stands between the companies that are trying to put products onto the market and the end users, the consumers. And for well over 100 years, this agency has been sort of like the hallmark of consumer protection. 25 cents out of every consumer dollar that is spent on a product regulated by FDA. And what the Trump administration is doing is the systematic destruction of that vital gatekeeper function, while also undermining trust in science and trust in government.
Well, I think it's a lot of people have talked about what we're seeing now as sort of the, you know, it was stuff that was tried in the first Trump administration, maybe a lot more slowly. Maybe there were guardrails in place from people in the administration. So I do think it's worth, though, talking a little about how things changed back from 2017 to 2021. So, Mitch Zeller, can you speak to that? How did the FDA change during the first Trump administration?
Sure. I think the biggest difference is Trump 1.0 installed political leadership at the agency. That understood the important public health mission of the agency. The initial commissioner that we had in the first Trump administration, Scott Gottlieb, had prior experience at FDA, was a cancer survivor, is a doc. For my piece of the FDA pie, which was regulating the tobacco industry, Scott's publicly supported game-changing policies. Banning menthol in cigarettes, reducing the nicotine content in cigarettes that no prior commissioner in Democratic administrations had publicly supported. So we were off to a great start at the beginning of the first Trump administration. And things declined, I think, towards the end. There was more, at least in for the products that I was responsible for, tobacco products, there was more interference from the White House that that we resisted. But that pales in comparison to what's going on now. There were no mass firings. There wasn't the elimination of entire offices. My former center, the Center for Tobacco Products, has taken a disproportionate hit in the firings, and two entire offices were eliminated. There was nothing like that in the first Trump administration, and it is sad to see what Trump 2.0 is doing to our beloved agency.
Susan, what do you think about that? And why do you think things are changed? Things are so much different this time around.
And I would concur with what Mitch said. When I first met with Dr. Gottlieb, I really was not sure what to expect. I was optimistic. I met with then Commissioner Gottlieb and said, I have a wonderful portfolio of work we could accomplish under your leadership that would improve nutrition in this country. And I presented it to him as a proposal, and he said, I want to do all of it. And I was so reassured that he understood the importance of chronic disease prevention, the science supporting that nutrition is a really important determinant, along with tobacco. Those are the two big ones, tobacco and nutrition. Big determinants of chronic disease in this country, and he was very supportive of the agenda and helped move forward policies like menu labeling during Trump 1.0 because it was good for consumers. It was also good for business, and he recognized that and moved that along. So I think the difference between that time and where we are today is I think we had folks who really understood the science, really understood the importance, and really, I think, served as guardrails across the administration. What we've seen today is none of that is occurring. Between the secretary, et cetera, we will have to see with the new commissioner. He hasn't been on board very long. But I'm hoping that Commissioner Makary will learn from Commissioner Gottlieb about ways that he could create a very positive legacy rather than the negative legacy that he has inherited at this moment in time. And so we will see where that heads.
Let me remind listeners, you can join us today at 800-222-9455. We also asked members of our texting group if they had questions or comments about what is happening in the federal government, particularly with regard to food and drug and tobacco regulation. We got a message from Sarah in Rockford that I think does get at the heart of the sort of pro-Trump voters case, at least some of them, about what they think of government. Sarah in Rockford says, I think the government was bloated and ineffective when all the workers were there. I welcome more streamlined processes. Now I'd like to see Illinois roll back its heavy regulations and bring sensible monitoring and open up permitting like mobile meat processing and open air meat processing for poultry. I'm going to end it there. Susan, I know meat is, you mentioned that's the Department of Ag. I'm not going to ask you about that, but can you respond to this idea that the government is, as Sarah said, quote, bloated and ineffective?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And again, speaking for the food side of it, which I led, in 1978, the center that I led had about 1,000 employees. And 40 years later, we had 1,100 employees. And the scope of the work that the center was responsible had increased exponentially. Today, so much of our food supply comes across our borders. We have an enormously complex food supply chain, ingredients coming in from other countries. We have innovative technologies today that regulators in the 1970s didn't have to address. And despite that, we increased very modestly. And so in terms of bloat on the food side of the house, I can say that is an inaccurate statement. In terms of the medical product side, the medical product side did grow, but that was in response to industry's need to have more predictable timelines around medical product reviews. In order to support innovation, industry, every day delay costs industry money in bringing new pharmaceuticals to market. And if FDA didn't have the personnel to complete those drug reviews in a timely basis, that slows down innovation and getting cures to patients in a timely fashion. So the user fee acts allowed industry to support FDA reviewers. They're not supporting the review itself, but to hire personnel to grow with the growing demand that the agency had. And so that is where the growth has been in the medical products, and it was necessary to support bringing cures to patients. We're all in favor of streamlining processes. I would say the last administration, we worked extremely hard. But unfortunately, a lot of the government systems have legacy technologies. It's hard to modernize at the same time that you're running an operation. But nonetheless, we worked very hard to modernize and streamline. That's been an ongoing area of work since I joined the federal government. I'm no longer a federal employee. But we can always do better. But laying off all the IT staff is certainly not the way to modernize technologies at the FDA.
Yeah. All right. We are going to take a break. We will continue this conversation with former FDA officials Susan Main and Mitch Zeller and Northwestern University researcher Joe Fineglass. If you want to join us today, again, the number is 800-222-9455. More to come. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are 100 days plus one into President Trump's administration. Funding has been cut from the FDA, the Federal Food and Drug Administration. People have been fired, and measures to protect food safety have been weakened. Also, it's not just the F in FDA that is under pressure from the administration. There have also been challenges to tobacco prevention efforts, as one example. We're talking about all this with Mitch Zeller, former director at the Center for Tobacco Products at the FDA, Joe Fineglass, research professor of medicine at Northwestern University, and Susan Main, former director at the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition at the FDA. If you want to join us, the number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. All right, Susan, I'm going to come back to you. Just can you then now sort of outline where do things stand as we are going to air today with, you know, cuts in funding, mass firings, deregulations?
Happy to. So all of those have occurred in terms of mass firings. It started with the probationary workers. FDA in the foods program lost a number of probationary workers, about 90 of them. That led to the director of the Human Foods Program at FDA to resign. So we saw that. Then we've seen the early retirements. We've seen the buyout offers. And the scary thing is that there has been zero transparency about where those losses have been across the program. I'm often asked, where are the greatest vulnerabilities? And I have to say, I'm honestly not sure because I don't know how many people have voluntarily left. But when I was there at the FDA, 20% of our workforce was eligible for regular retirement. These are folks who stay beyond their retirement eligibility date because they love the work. I understand with the change of the criteria to voluntary early retirement, it was approximately 40% of the workforce. So if that is the case, and we lose 40% to retirements on top of the RIFs, the reduction in forces, those are the terminations and the firings, we're in serious trouble of dismantling way beyond the lowest numbers ever for the FDA. I'm just very concerned about that. You also mentioned deregulation. We are seeing it. We saw it in the first Trump 1.0 administration. We're seeing deregulation that will absolutely damage food safety. Things like the Food Safety Modernization Act required traceability for high-risk foods from end to end, meaning that when we have an outbreak of leafy greens, we would be able to trace that leafy green back to the farm level. And we have been working on this for years. The compliance date for industry to meet for traceability was January 1st of 2026, and the administration delayed it by 30 months, 2.5 years. That is unprecedented, and that will hurt consumers. That will lead to more people getting sick and foodborne outbreaks. They recently rolled back a salmonella rule in poultry. USDA was working to say you cannot sell poultry products that have certain strains of salmonella that make people sick. They rolled that back. So it's now okay, as it has been in the past, to sell poultry that is known to be contaminated with salmonella that makes people sick. And so we're seeing across the board advisory committees, an advisory committee that was charged with helping FDA look at the science on how to prevent bacterial contamination of infant formula. That committee had labored for 2 years to get that best science to FDA, independent of FDA, and the advisory committee was disbanded before the report was concluded. So what is the rationale for not having science on preventing bacterial contamination in infant formula see the light of day? That makes no sense. So these are the types of signals, the types of changes, clear, concrete changes that we have seen that are damaging the food safety infrastructure in this country as we speak.
Mitch Zeller, how do you understand these sorts of cuts and rollbacks and delays affecting what you were involved with, which is tobacco prevention?
It's the systematic destruction of the Center for Tobacco Products, which has taken a disproportionate hit from the firings compared to FDA agency-wide. While the administration has been utterly opaque in sharing the numbers, I have been able to obtain some numbers. And when we talk about all of the probationary employees that were fired in March, the FDA-wide average was about 4% of the FDA workforce. In my old center, which had worked very hard to respond to complaints by the e-cigarette industry about the backlog of applications that were still pending review, over the last year, the Center for Tobacco Products did a remarkable job of hiring more than 80 people in the Office of Science to help address the backlog. All those people were fired as probationary employees. And these were not just junior people. If you came in and took on a new management responsibility, you were considered a probationary employee. They were all fired. And so for the new secretary or the new commissioner to say that this has been done to address either performance or efficiency is, I think, rather deceptive on their part. Sure, the government can do better. FDA can do better. My old center can do better. But they took a chainsaw to the workforce, a chainsaw, and they did it almost immediately. So the timing alone belies any claim by the administration that this was done strategically and to deal with efficiency. And it's particularly ironic in the tobacco center, which does not spend $1 of taxpayer money. The Center for Tobacco Products at FDA is entirely funded by industry user fees. It's the only center that is 100% user fee funded. So for the administration to claim that this is saving money is also a deceptive, if not an outright lie, because not one taxpayer dollar is spent to regulate the tobacco industry.
What does this actually mean for consumers? Somebody who is, you know, maybe a user of some of these products, or they're worried about their kids using some of these products. How does this actually translate into real world effects?
It's going to make it harder for FDA to do its compliance and enforcement work, because while that's one of the offices that survived the reduction in force, we don't know the extent of the reduction in force in that office. There has been reporting on serious cutbacks in the ability of that Office of Compliance and Enforcement to take an enforcement action against retailers that illegally sell tobacco products to minors. I think that the threat to public health here is, as we were talking earlier about that vital gatekeeping function that all of the FDA centers play in standing between consumers and these products, but especially for tobacco, because there is no inherent benefit to any tobacco product, unlike all the other products that FDA regulates, which have some benefit to society. Tobacco products have absolutely no benefit. FDA was put in the business of regulating tobacco products to account for the relative risk between different categories of tobacco products and to try to reduce the death and disease from a category of products that remains the leading cause of completely preventable disease and death in the country and in the world. And the chainsaw that the Trump administration has taken to the agency and to my old center imperils public health, because there will be fewer scientists to review applications, fewer people to take enforcement action, and a completely demoralized surviving workforce. And it is a shame that this has all happened with a complete lack of accountability for the administration.
Joe Fineglass, I hear phrases like chainsaw, wrecking ball. You talked about, you know, this time when American health outcomes are declining and not on par with other sort of peer nations. How are you viewing these cuts and layoffs?
Well,
and so
the
on?
Discussion of the FDA is exactly in line with what's going on in the rest of the health and human services world, and the whole destruction of centers in the NIH, cancellation of thousands of NSF and NIH grants that were basically mostly focused on healthcare for the poor, and the entire wiping out of a generation of new government employees who had been coming into government with through training programs and through things like data science programs that could have actually made the kind of changes in efficiency and government responsiveness that we need. So this has nothing whatsoever to do with improving the efficiency of government. This has to do with wiping out the liberal, what is viewed as a liberal industry views, at least as a liberal anti-regulatory, anti-science type message. A lot of this has to do with the larger struggle that is going on against universities in general in the United States. So again, 10,000 jobs were people were fired, another 10,000 left in early retirement. We're talking about wiping out injury prevention, wiping out occupational health and safety, no more National Institute for Occupational Health and Safety. They're even cutting things like the people who do the screenings for black lung. Even though they love the miners, they're cutting offices of the agencies that actually support my health. And so you have a situation where this is beyond just having anything to do with government efficiency, and it's part of a larger strategy of the Trump administration to go after liberal centers of power in the United States. NIH, by the way, generates something like $4 for every $1 spent on NIH funding. NIH funding has been flat, actually, since the early 2000s. In inflation-adjusted dollars, it has not gone up. And yet these are the people that have brought us things like GLP-1, weight loss drugs, statin drugs, things of that nature that many millions of Americans have benefited. So why do they want to cut the NIH by over 20% in the current budget when, in fact, this is just going to prevent a whole new generation of scientists from who have been trained to come into this field? Again, they've wiped out training programs. They've wiped out thousands of jobs in these different areas, and $12 billion in cuts to state and local health departments.
Susan, you know, there's always been this push and pull between industry and regulators and people who are trying to look out for safety. I mean, that is a very old story in America. How is it, or is it, I guess, different now? And how is it different under this current administration versus what has been, you know, a part of your work, I'm sure, for decades?
Well, I think what's really different under the current administration is that they're not following the science. There is a push and pull. FDA wants to take a regulatory action to protect consumers that may involve, banning an ingredient in foods. And I was there when we took the very difficult step of banning partially hydrogenated oils from the food supply, because the science said that it was no longer generally recognized as safe. Of course, industry was not happy about that. Industry went to some congressional members. I had to defend that action in front of members of Congress, but we followed the science. And I think that's what's different today, is not really following the science. And instead of really addressing the main determinants of diet-related chronic disease, I'll speak about diet. You know, I was really excited about what MAHA could do. Let's really, really address diet-related chronic disease. And I was anticipating, let's try to get more fruits and vegetables and whole grain into the food supply. Let's reduce added sugars and sodium and all these things we know are detrimental to our health. And instead, what we've seen is a hyper-focus on specific things that really are not driving those trends, things like synthetic food dyes. A lot of misinformation. Secretary Kennedy has claimed that there's an explosion of cancer and these food dyes are causing that. There isn't an explosion of cancer. Cancer death rates have been going down. And where they're going up, it's due to obesity. And we're not addressing the causes of obesity. So I see so much potential to do good for health, including chronic disease risk reduction. But by not following the science and focusing in on things that are not the big determinants, it's really undermining public health.
Joe, can you tell us what's going on? Tell us a little bit about the Moffitt Lab in Chicago. I understand some employees are getting their jobs back. What kind of work are they doing there?
I'm sorry, did you say the Moffitt Lab?
Yeah, do I have that right?
No, I'm not actually familiar with that one, but there are major cuts to multiple grant-funded programs at Northwestern. There's a current freeze on all Northwestern future grant awards, and I'm not sure if that's what you're referring to.
Okay.
Well, perhaps I can jump in on the Moffitt Lab.
Sure. Yeah,
because that was one of our FDA-funded centers. So at the Illinois Institute of Technology, FDA had a group of FDA scientists in a division there called the Division of Food Processing Science and Technology. And they really did some very highly innovative work looking at things like innovations in processing technologies and how that can make food more safe. Now, things like food packaging, what is the impact of food packaging on food safety? They also ran a really critical function in terms of running what we call proficiency testing for state labs, so that if our federal state partnership to look at things like contamination levels in foods, in order for that to work, we need to have all the labs proficiently measuring whatever the contaminant of interest is. And these folks here in Illinois were leading those initiatives. And despite what you heard from Macari, Commissioner Macari, as well as from the secretary, they stated no scientists were cut with the reductions in force. That is untrue. All of these scientists were cut. The entire division was cut. But there has been a lot of public outcry because things like bird flu testing in milk was stopped. The proficiency testing was stopped as a result of these people being terminated. They said that no scientists working on chemical safety were cut. Well, they were. And so what we are now hearing is the administration has stated that they will work to bring these scientists back. But as of this morning, my indication is that none of these folks have gotten anything in writing that they are being reinstated, but they have a verbal that they will be brought back. But it just highlights, again, the chainsaw approach of cutting some of the very same people who are experts in chem safety, who are experts in chemicals in food packaging, cutting those people. Clearly, this was not done intentionally and to be consistent with what they have communicated as the priorities of the administration.
And if I could add
briefly, we need to take a break. Go ahead. Yeah.
The great unknown about the impact on state and local tobacco control efforts. I'll give Virginia as an example.
You know what? I'm sorry to interrupt you because it sounds like I do want to hear that. We have to take a break. We're on a fixed clock on our show, and we do have to take a break very soon. So I'm going to ask you to pause on that. We will talk about the tobacco prevention efforts and how that is also we're seeing that playing out in the real world here on the 21st show. Let me remind listeners, if you want to join us today, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. More with former FDA officials Susan Main and Mitch Zeller and Northwestern researcher Joe Fineglass when we return. This is the 21st show. Please stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the Trump administration's taking what some on our panel today have described as a chainsaw to the work of the FDA, which is something that's been happening across government. But we today are focusing on food and the Food and Drug Administration, how that's affecting things like food safety, potentially, and tobacco prevention efforts. And we are speaking about this with Joe Fineglass, who's a research professor of medicine at Northwestern University, Susan Main, former director at the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition at the FDA, and presently on the faculty at Yale University, and Mitch Zeller, who is former director at the Center for Tobacco Products at the FDA. 800-222-9455 to join us. Mitch, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you before the break. You were about to tell us about Virginia.
Yeah. So there's this little-known office in CDC that has either been completely eliminated or decimated. It's known as the Office on Smoking and Health. And they were a major provider of funds to all states and territories to do tobacco prevention and treatment efforts at the state and local level. We're waiting for the other shoe to fall in terms of what's going to happen to the money. But Virginia is an example of a state that 100% of its statewide tobacco prevention program is funded by the federal government. And the people that run that program are sort of holding their breath to see what's going to happen to their entire program, since, you know, we could say, well, the state legislature should step in, and maybe they should, but it's a state that relies for 100 cents out of every dollar in what is really a mom and apple pie program, and that is trying to prevent kids from starting to use tobacco products and helping addicted cigarette smokers who are interested in quitting try to quit. I mean, it doesn't get any more basic public health than that, and almost apolitical. I mean, who would object to either of those programmatic efforts? And we're waiting to see what the budget cuts will be following the reductions in force at CDC that has basically eliminated that entire office.
We asked members of our texting group what they thought about this, and I want to spend the last part of our program today on the sort of the why as to what might be happening, what is happening might be happening, I should say. We heard from Ryan in Champaign, who thought it's a money grab, quote. That's the only thing he wants. If he can kill and hurt the poor while he's at it, then more joy for him. Don't try to pretend he has any other intentions. Something similar from Kevin in Farina, who says nothing he'll do in the future will benefit anyone. Years of improvements and protections will be destroyed to no good end. Those who voted for him, I'm going to say, will get what they deserve. Unfortunately, they'll take the rest of us down with them. God save us from ourselves, Kevin said. Again, if you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. Joe, I'm going to start with you. What are your thoughts as to why what is happening is happening?
Well, this I love those text messages. I have thought about this a lot, and it's obviously gone beyond just simply we need to cut government so that we have funding for the Trump tax cuts to be continued. So there is a narrative that, you know, all of these cuts are needed, you know, because if we reduce the size of government, we can afford to give tax cuts to billionaires that we gave the last time and corporations that we gave the last time under the Trump administration. I think that's simplistic. I think what's going on here is more ideological. And it's the idea of seeing the scientific establishment of the United States as sort of a center of woke liberalism and what they often refer to as cultural Marxism. And I don't know exactly how to put this, but there is a sort of antagonism here that goes way beyond. This is not just chainsaw. This is attacking the liberal components of the federal government that are seen as socialist and that are seen as basically trying to prevent corporate control over government. We have a billionaire cabinet who have now been, you know, put in power with a very ruthless agenda. And so again, it's very difficult for me to separate what's going on with the FDA from what's going on with the destruction of, you know, funding for addiction and mental health, funding for homeless care. You know, the whole infectious disease structure of the United States has been gutted by these NIH grant terminations that obviously include a lot of the USAID work in Africa, but HIV will come back here. It will not just be in Africa. It will come back to the United States, even at a time when we could have been thinking about eradicating HIV as a disease. We're now thinking about, you know, things like measles and, you know, other bird flu is another example, but measles coming back as an endemic disease. And it's the kind of retrogression that we see also in the United States prior to the Trump administration with regard to differences between the red states and the blue states. So there's already a huge life expectancy gap between states that have been run by, you know, particularly by Republican trifectas, where they have both branches of the legislature and the governor's office. We've done a lot of research on how it is that things like pregnancy and birth outcomes are different in those states, even after you control for all the individual risk factors of women. There is a huge difference and growing difference in life expectancy. States like Connecticut that became more liberal versus Oklahoma, but they became more conservative, produce a 2 or 3 year life expectancy gap, a difference over time. And so, you know, we already know this from the kind of government that we see in Republican states being applied now to the national level. And I do question, like, what is the ideological reasons for this? But it's certainly entrenched in terms of the sort of basic idea that there has to be a change in the way that the government controls civil society in the United States, and it's part of an authoritarian takeover.
Susan, I mean, people across the political spectrum, no matter who you voted for, people get cancer, they get HIV, they get sick from tainted produce at, you know, their favorite restaurant. How do you understand this change that's happening and, you know, how the people are letting it happen, right? How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, it's tough. First, I'll start with the observation that consumers expect the federal government to play a role in food safety. We recognize food in this country is regulated post-market. That means that we don't review every food before it goes into the food supply for safety, that basically the federal government, like FDA, reacts when something goes wrong. And they can work to help prevent contamination. That was the type of science that has been going on at the Moffitt Center in Illinois, preventing contamination, sharing that science with industry. But the real function is to intervene when there's contaminated food and get it off the market and keep people well. So how do I think about it? It seems to me that it's just universally trying to attack science so that people no longer trust in science, trying to attack government so people don't trust in government, and controlling the narrative and controlling the messaging. One of the initial steps that the Trump administration did was they fired all of the communicators from the Human Foods Program at FDA, who filled an extremely important function in communicating with all of our country about food safety issues and recalls and all of these things. They were all terminated, and they said, instead, we're going to handle all the communications at the HHS level led by Secretary Robert F. Kennedy. That was a huge red flag to me, because in the normal communications mode, we would be writing press releases with the scientists reviewing everyone for scientific accuracy. That is all gone out the window now. And we are seeing press releases come out with blatant inaccuracies, verifiable untruths, it's controlling the message and controlling the narrative. So that's what I'm seeing.
And Mitch, let me ask you about with tobacco? I mean, it was what, it was in the 1960s when the Surgeon General's report came out. Our own Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. It was in the 80s when he got smoking banned on airplanes and started the ball rolling on the clean indoor air we now all, or at least many of us, enjoy. Are we going back to a country where tobacco use is? Are they trying to make it more acceptable? Where do you see this going?
No, I don't think they're trying to do that at all. As a country, we can pause and applaud that we have historically low adult and youth cigarette smoking rates. Nonetheless, it remains the leading cause of preventable disease and death, as I said earlier. I think what I would add to what Joe and Susan said is more of a sort of systemic take, and that is our unique form of democracy. There have been democracies around forever, but ours is unique because there were supposed to be three co-equal branches of government. I spent 5 years in the late 80s and the early 90s as counsel to an oversight subcommittee in the House that did oversight of the Reagan administration and the first Bush administration. And this was the last vestiges of bipartisan oversight. If I needed a subpoena, all the Republicans voted for the subpoena. We have lost the notion of co-equal branches of government. And so whatever Trump is trying to do, which could have been held more to account politically through checks and balances, if there generally was a third co-equal branch of government running the legislative affairs of the country, that is dysfunctional. It has broken down and it has enabled Trump to do what he is doing. So until we somehow restore the constitutional checks and balances that are supposed to exist on an executive branch that has run amok like this administration has done, I don't know what the solution is, short or medium term, until we wait for the next set of elections to see if there's any change.
Yeah, Congress should. Yeah, okay. So, Susan, let me ask you in the couple minutes we have remaining, from a consumer standpoint, what should people be doing to stay safe at this time, as we're, you know, talking about this potential rise in foodborne illness is one example?
Well, I think consumers should be making their voices heard, that they expect the federal government to play a key role.
Joe, what do you think about that? What can people do here? If people are listening to this, they're frustrated. We heard a recent message, Kelly in Whiteheath said, why it's idiotic to deregulate food safety. I guess we're going back to Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, Make America Gag Again. What do you think about that? What can everyday people do here?
Well, I think, I think this is a political question for those of us who are opposing the current regime. I do actually actively encourage people to get out in the streets. And truthfully, I'm not sure about the two branches of government, the judiciary or the congressional route, of actually having any major effect at this point in time. I therefore don't think we have any choice but to get out and demonstrate and try to convince our fellow citizens about stuff and make protest a big part of the opposition. I'm not sure what the alternative to that is. And I'm an old activist. I believe you can change government in the long run by changing people's hearts and minds. And we've got to get out and communicate with the public about what's going on, and that this has nothing to do with streamlining government. This has to do with destroying government and destroying the ability for the government to serve the interests of the whole working class of the United States and not just the wealthy.
Mitch, what would you recommend to people if they want to protect themselves or get active here?
I think we need leaders from any sector that are willing to go to bat for a renewed faith in science, the truth, and facts. Whatever it takes to do that, so that individual consumers who rely on government to play this consumer protection role can have restored faith in science-based regulatory agencies like FDA. We're going to have to change the paradigm. We're going to have to change the public's perception of science. The Trump administration has been very successful in undermining faith in science. And by doing that, they are undermining faith in science-based regulatory agencies like FDA. So we need leaders. It can be celebrities. It can be well-recognized doctors. It can come from any sector to mount a campaign to restore faith in science and in science-based agencies like FDA.
Mitch Zeller is former director at the Center for Tobacco Products at the FDA. Susan Main was director of the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition at the FDA. She's now at Yale. And Joe Feinglass is research professor of medicine at Northwestern University. Susan, Mitch, and Joe, thank you so much for sharing your perspectives with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks.
Pleasure.
That is it for us today. Coming up tomorrow on the 21st Show, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker offered some fiery remarks at a party fundraiser, a Democratic Party fundraiser for in New Hampshire over the weekend. We'll talk about whether Pritzker is teeing himself up for a presidential campaign. We're also going to talk about this push to bring manufacturing back to the U.S. and just how possible that is. We'll talk with the owner of the country's only Made in America store. They purport that all their products, from inputs to the finished products, are made in America. We'll talk about that tomorrow here on the 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Colson Kahn. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We will talk with you again tomorrow.